Welcome to The Morning Crew, a grief podcast hosted by three gals in their mid-20s. Here, talking about grief is completely normal and a part of our everyday life. So grab a cup of coffee or a drink. Grief conversations can actually be that casual. So let's talk about it.
Welcome, everybody. We are so excited for today's episode. For anyone who is a first-time listener, we are three millennial gals who kind of have all experienced grief, wanted to normalize talking about all the things that come along with losing somebody. And we are excited today to have this conversation with a new author and grief coach who just came out with her book that we are so excited about. So please welcome Emily Bingham. So Emily is a certified grief educator, grief coach, widow, and founder of Move Through. After the loss of her husband in 2019 to uveal melanoma, she started Move Through, a grief coaching business, which helped to create new meaning out of her tragedy by helping others heal. Not only has Emily worked with hundreds of clients in both private and coaching groups, but she also has reached millions of followers through her social media content. Her goal is to help anyone who has experienced a loss embrace grief through movement and mindset. And she just released her first book, Love and Grief, which we are very excited to hear all about today. So thank you, Emily.
Wow, thank you. Thanks for having me. This is great.
No, we are so excited that you're here and we're having this conversation. We know how much this will mean to our listeners and our audiences. So we're just very excited. So before we dive into all things grief, we kind of just want to get to know you, where you're from, kind of the basics, how you were like as a kid and just growing up with your family.
Oh, I love that. I know. I feel like we talk so much on like the grief and the death, we forget who we are kind of in the process. So that's great. So I'm Emily. I live here in Denver, Colorado with my two kids, and I recently moved in with my new partner and his two teenage boys. So we have like kids spanning a decade apart.
Oh, wow.
So that's been new and really fun and challenging, but overall just really beautiful. Okay, so me as a kid, I would say I was always moving. I was like the girl, you know, dressing up in her princess outfit, dancing around the living room, just like nonstop singing and dancing and just pretending like life was this fairy tale, you know? Like that's kind of, and I think I've carried that essence into who I am as an adult. I see a lot of the light and the good in things. It's one of my greatest strengths, and it's also one of my biggest weaknesses, especially when it comes to grief and really facing the pain of these experiences. But I love to move. I love to dance. I love to work out. I love the outdoors, the sunshine, good music, like going out for a good concert. Yeah, just spending time with my friends and family.
That is amazing. And it's great to hear how you've kept your kind of essence as a child into your adulthood. And I remember even in the opening of your book, you kind of write about how you had a really positive upbringing and how that kind of like impacted later on why loss and grief was like so heavy, I'm sure, because it was a kind of like these newer feelings. Can you talk a little bit more about that kind of really positive upbringing, or maybe if you were just close with your family, anything else you liked doing with your family specifically?
Yeah, I think I was raised, you know, with a lot of privilege. My parents, we had a nice home growing up. We all went to school. It wasn't like, you know, we're struggling in any way. I got to go to ballet school and on trips and do all of the things that you would want to do in your childhood. I had all the opportunity going to college, getting a job. I was just kind of on that straight and arrow trajectory toward happiness and success, or at least what we subscribe to as happiness and success here in the US, right? I met my college sweetheart. We fell in love. We started a family, and you know, he was diagnosed early on. I can talk about that more later. But we just kind of like, we're just like, oh, it's fine. We got the tumor removed. It'll be fine. And just proceeded on with life. And I think his actual death really just burst my bubble. It was like, whoa, like a wake-up call that you know, life isn't predictable or guaranteed, that bad things actually do happen and they happen all of the time. And I'm not immune to those struggles, just like anybody else. But I don't know, like in my mind, I think just because of my childhood and my conditioning and, you know, I would see struggle from afar, but never really believe that that could happen to me. And so once it did, it was earth shattering. It changed my entire life and perspective around the world.
I appreciate that you said you kind of to the idea of like subscribing to whatever we think is like the happiness or the success that you're supposed to do, because that's a definitely a relatable thought. And you did kind of walk us through, you know, you went to college, you kind of had this really positive upbringing. And I want to hear a little bit about how and when you met your husband.
Yes. So it's actually very synchronistic, because the house that I just moved into with my partner, David, like I look out the window, I'm sitting here right now talking to you guys, and I can see the dorm room where Ian and I, like, you know, fell in love, which is so crazy.
Wow, that is wild.
Yeah. So we met as freshmen in college, and immediately I just like saw him coming down the hallway, and I was like, this guy is so hot. I've got to get to know him. Like, oh my gosh. He was like this surfer from Hawaii. I was like this strict ballerina girl, and he was like so cool. And yeah, I just totally head over heels in love. And we were inseparable in college. Yeah, spent every moment together. He just had this way of making you feel so special and seen, like you're the most important person in the room. And yeah, like the rest was really history. But that is how we met, was in college.
That is so dang cute. And I have chills. Absolutely. The fact that you can look out and see the dorm life is so crazy. And I feel like once you do experience a loss, you're so much more aware for those signs and those signals. What was your marriage like and creating a family together? How do you approach having kids? We'd love to hear kind of how that grew from college love to a full family.
Yeah, well, our story was kind of wild. So after graduation, we decided to take a break because he was going to China to pursue hotel tourism and restaurant management. And I was going to get a graduate degree over in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we just thought, you know, maybe we need a little break to see what life is like apart, to explore our passions and our career. And so we took a break, and it was actually, it's funny because in hindsight, that was like my first experience with grief. Like I didn't know it at the time. I didn't even have a word to name what I was feeling, but I was like, oh, the void and the emptiness and just the longing for him then. Oh my God, it was so big. So yeah, you can grieve people who are living, who are alive. And it was actually during that time when Ian was first diagnosed with cancer. So I remember the call like it was yesterday, as anyone who's gone through a terminal illness does. The diagnosis day, you know, you start grieving the life as you knew it from that day. But yeah, we got the diagnosis. Ironically, that's kind of what brought us back together. He had to come back to the United States to get treatment. And so we were treating it. But again, like there was a hint of denial about like life isn't going to go that way. We're going to beat this. And I think just the scare kind of forced us to really focus on what mattered. And we're like, our careers are great, but we also really love each other. And so from there, he came back. He proposed. We moved from Miami back out to San Diego, and we started a family. Sorry, I guess I skipped over our wedding, which happened in Colorado. And the wedding was—it's funny because to us it was just magic. You know, you dream of that day as a little girl, and that's all it was. But to people who were older than us, who had experienced loss, like someone like my dad, also who's a doctor. He was like, I was walking you down the aisle, and I knew that there was a 50% shot that he would make it or a 50% shot that he would not. And so I didn't see it at the time, but everybody else did. And they said it was like so beautiful because there was that duality, right? Of like something so awful and something so beautiful all intertwined in one. And I think that's what like cancer, death, grief does, is it's so hard to feel and to be with. And at the same time, it amplifies all of the goodness in life, right? So yeah, our wedding was really bittersweet to most. To us, we just had a hell of a good time. And then from there, we started our family, and it was beautiful. I mean, we were like this young little California family going to the beach, having a lot of fun. Cancer felt like it was very much in the background. And then it wasn't until 2017, when I was pregnant with my second kid, where we got the diagnosis.
I'm very curious. And I read a little bit about this in the beginning of the book, and I thought the way that you talked about it was really amazing. And something that, I mean, I'm going to be an aunt this year, and something that I was literally highlighted and took notes on for how to talk about grief with them. But how old were the kids when they found out, and how did you guys decide to handle it with them?
So we were very open and honest the entire time. There was like no sugarcoating. And I don't quite know why we did it that way. Maybe it's partially because of, you know, my past and thinking I lived in a fairy tale. And it's like, no, like this stuff happens. And so we were just very direct. I know with kids, they have that like magical thinking, right? So we were both really open and honest about not only the diagnosis, but also his death. So, you know, Izzy and Theo, daddy has cancer. Cancer isn't an illness that like you and me can get, but it is an illness of the body. It makes his body being in a lot of pain. He's not going to be able to do certain things. He really wants to do these things with you, right? And some of the medicine that he's going to take is going to make him feel really sick. You know, reassuring them that it wasn't their fault, that we're doing the best that we can. And just trying to normalize it all for them, I think, was really our main focus.
First, just thank you for explaining all of that so thoughtfully and so eloquently. And I think going back to what you said about the wedding, how grief and cancer and these tough diagnoses can make the beautiful moments that much more beautiful and special. And there really is such a duality to that. So I think that's a great takeaway for anyone listening, that though the bad moments are bad and they're low, that the little things you appreciate so much more and you cherish so much more. And that's so interesting how you two were able to be so present in your wedding. And it was really the people around you who were kind of weighing the bigger picture. And thank you for being honest about how you approach your kids. I know that's something that I think any parent, and like Kathy was a kid on the receiving end, I was the kid on the receiving end. So it means a lot to hear that. When it was getting closer to his passing and that was becoming more of a reality, and I know this is obviously the toughest part to talk about, so feel free to be briefer, but when that day did come, like, what was it, a surprise when the day came? Did you know that was happening? How did you handle it with your beautiful family?
Yeah. That whole time was just so surreal, as you know, right? Ian was admitted into hospice, literally, and this is so synchronistic now that I'm thinking about it, on March 1st, which is, we're recording this on the 29th. March 2nd is my son's first birthday. Well, back then, it was his first birthday. So I associate like my son turning one with Ian's death 4 days later. So I think when he was in hospice, I like still felt like there was this glimmer of hope that like maybe he'd come out of it. Like if he could just get the pain under control and like then he could start doing more things like going into the ocean like he had hoped for, because he's from Hawaii and so that's where he passed away. So I don't think it really truly hit me until the hospice nurse told me like the night before he was going to pass that he was dying. She's like, I think that you know, he's showing the signs that he will pass probably within the next 24 hours. And honestly, I couldn't even feel it. Like I completely 100% dissociated at that time. I didn't know that that's what I was doing, but I was just numb and detached and it was happening. I could like see it like a movie, but like I couldn't feel and engage with the reality of what was actually going down. So yeah, I think that night I kind of said my goodbyes to him in the best way that I could. I think I told him how much I loved him, how much of an impact he made, and that we would be okay. Those were like the three things that our hospice nurse said to tell a dying person. And I really valued that because I didn't know how to handle that situation, right? And so Ian passed away the morning of March 26th, super early. I wasn't there, and I'm at peace with that. He passed alone when the nurse left, and I don't think that he would have done it any other way. I think he had a lot of pride, and he was like, peace out. I'm going surfing at Dawn Patrol. I'm out. And my kids actually didn't say goodbye to him beforehand. A couple of days before, they were like lying in bed with him and talking to him, but they did say goodbye after. And you know, I woke up that morning and I said, Izzy, your dad passed away last night. Do you want to say goodbye to him? And she just kind of looked at me like, what? And she was like, no. I was like, all right, let's go make some breakfast. Let's go pour some Cheerios. Like, and again, the duality of that, right? It's like, okay, so we went and had our Cheerios, and then she turns to me and she's like, so mom, wait, what'd you say about daddy? Like, I want to go say goodbye to him. So we went in there, and yeah, it was just so rough. Like, she just leaned up against the bed and said, goodbye, daddy. And she had no idea what was probably going on at the time. She was 3 years old. And she said her goodbye, and then we went on and proceeded with our day. And it's funny, you guys, because I actually read her. I talk about that chapter in the book, that memory in the book, and I read it to her last night. And she just started crying, and I just held her. And I was like, after I just held her for a little bit and like let her – you know, let the emotion pass. I was like, so what came up for you? And she just goes, your words are so powerful, mommy. I was like, who are you?
What a sweetheart.
It was really sweet. So yeah, it's just wild for her, I'm sure, too, to see herself in that, but to not to understand it at the time. And now as a 8-year-old, you know, she has more of a grasp of what death is, and that her daddy hasn't been here, and that we're also okay, and that it's okay to be sad. Like, I think I diverged from the original question.
It's perfect. It's perfect. And it actually leads me into one, because like I said, that part, the part of how you were talking that about how you talk to the children, really stuck with me, and was something I thought was really amazing. And you mentioned that Izzy, I think you said, came up to you and was like, so is it just like poof, he was gone? Yeah. And I'm curious, is like, as they're aging, does that continue to come up, or are they kind of in a spot where they understand it more now?
Yeah, so it's funny because that was the part where they had taken Ian's body to the morgue, and Izzy was like, where'd it go? I was like, the stars in the sky. And because I was like, how the hell do I explain cremation to exactly. This 3-year-old? Like, no. So that one, I was like, we're just gonna let that slide, you know? And she was like, poof. So yeah, ever since then, I've talked about Ian being in the stars and the sun and the sky and in the air, right? Like it's a daddy tickle or something. Like I'm trying to build that spirituality for them and just give them some tools to maintain a connection to him in spirit and however they decide to do that. So I've definitely tried to explain death, cancer, anything that's kind of happened at a more age-appropriate level, but I'm also like not trying to force it on them, right? Like if they have questions coming up, I'll answer. And then if I'm going through a degree of grief or something, I'll try to explain what's happening. I can't remember if I've actually explained like cremation and spreading ashes. And I mean, I'm still even like, how does that even happen?
Right.
But you know, but yeah, I'm trying to present it to them as like, just like I did with the cancer, as like openly and unbiased as I can, so that they can kind of, there's room for their own interpretation as to what this means to them.
And I just so appreciate, again, also the approach you've kind of taken with your kids. And thank you for being honest about those final days, too. I know it's kind of a tougher moment to focus on, but super important in what we're talking about all the time. So just appreciate that honesty. You've talked a little bit about how you've supported them, but I'm really curious kind of who has been your support system and who has like kind of been there for you. I think you even said something about somebody donating their house or some sort of house, which really blew me away. If you could speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was amazing. So what happened is we went out to Hawaii thinking it would be a vacation. We were actually hoping to return back to Colorado for one more treatment to give it like a Hail Mary shot, right? But once we got to Hawaii, we had to check into hospice because Ian's pain was out of control. So we get to Hawaii and of course, like where do you stay? his parents were there. His mom has an apartment, but like we needed hospital beds. We had equipment. We had the kids, right? So luckily a friend asked another friend and we were already going to stay in their house for like a couple days for vacation. And they kind of donate their home to like friends and family who are visiting every now and then. But this woman, and I remember we were supposed to stay there like for 4 days and then another family was going to come. And we told her our situation and she said, no, you guys stay in the house. I'll find other accommodations for them. And you guys just stay here for as long as you want. Like, I was like, I don't know how long it's going to be for him to pass away. And because you don't, right? It could be a month. It could be six. And she said, it's fine. It's fine. You guys use it. And it was like this beautiful beach home overlooking the Twin Islands, the Mokuluas in Hawaii. I don't know if you're familiar, but Ian used to surf there. Like it was like his favorite spot. So it was just so beautiful. And that made the death so much easier to accept. I think when you go through a really traumatic death, like it's really hard to move through that trauma and to be at peace. Whereas like for me, like I got to say goodbye. The ocean breeze was like coming in like on us in the room. He could feel that. Like it just felt so much more natural. Like you could almost relate it to the natural cycles of life too, because we were just surrounded by so much beauty.
It's just amazing. Like you said, like the fact that we're talking today and that if it wasn't a leap year, today would be March 1st. And the fact that you planned on going back for another treatment and that he ended up going in the place that he loved and the place he was from is really just, it's beautiful and it's amazing.
Yeah. When you can like surrender and trust and right. It's like, it's all happening for us in a really twisted way. It doesn't feel like that, but yeah. But to your other point, sorry, we received a ton of support from friends and family. Like in Hawaii, everyone is your ohana and like they showed up. It was amazing. Like people just dropping groceries by, watching the kids, cleaning the house, whatever it was. It was harder when I got back to Colorado, but I still had tremendous support from my family and my friends. But I also want to say that like for me, I don't know. I think because I was 32 and a young widow and like my friends could like see me and hear me, but they couldn't like, they could, I mean, and I know you guys have experienced this too, because you had losses young. It's like they can show compassion, but to really be there with you in it was a different story. So that's why I turned to social media and they became like my community of emotional support that I needed.
That's incredibly relatable to us because like you said, being young, and it's obviously a blessing. Most people don't experience such big losses this young, but it is literally why the three of us started this podcast and found each other on a social media group because we felt like there wasn't, and it's hard to relate to your peers who mean so, so well to try to be there for you. But unless you've experienced it, you just don't know. So walk us through then, you start with social media. What does that look like? I think a blog first, and tell us how that kind of snowballed. You become a grief coach. So you're getting all these certifications, like you dove into the space and have also been giving back, which is so beautiful.
Yeah, totally. And I want to just name something too. It's like friends and family, like we need your support. Like, please don't take that as like, oh, 100%. Like you're worthless to us because you've never been through a loss. It's not like that. It's just that it's like there's another community that we also need to like really feel seen and validated in our grief. So it's both, right? So yeah, I I started, actually, the reason I started sharing on social media is because I had been sharing on a GoFundMe page to cover Ian's medical bills. And anytime that I come from a content marketing background. So I was like, okay, well, what's like the value add here? As if we needed one. But I was like, you know, like I would want to like give an update, but then also be like, here's the lesson. I don't know why. It was just the way that I wrote these things. And so people started reaching out and they said, you know, like, I'm really enjoying your shares. They're always providing me a different insight on my life or some sort of like inspiration. And so that exchange was healing in itself. And after Ian passed, they were like, are you going to keep writing? And I decided, yes, I would, because just the act of writing and processing, it was such a release. Like, writing about what I was going through gave me the space to process. And like, I would literally, like, this week I've been doing the same thing, writing a speech for Ian for the book, right? And just cry. And then when I would share it, you know, young widows or other grievers of all types of losses would say, oh my gosh, I feel this way too. And so I would feel seen. And they would feel seen by my post. And then their words saying that mine were helping them started to give new meaning to my loss. And so right around the 6-month mark after Ian died, when I was kind of at a crossroads of what the fuck do I do with my life? Do I go back to my corporate 9-to-5 or, you know, do I try to find something more, not only more meaningful, but like I was a solo mom. So I needed something that was more flexible too, that could, where I could be there for my kids and not have to be grinding, you know? So that's where I thought, well, how can I like turn this into something? And I hired a coach. Her name is Jackie Carr. She's a goal coach. When we just kind of put our heads together and she helped me come up with Move Through, which at the time it looks totally different than it does now. I was a fitness instructor, a spin instructor. And so Move Through started out as a intention-based workout on a spin bike where no doubt you just came into the room. I'd turn off the lights. We'd turn on like moody music and we'd just ride and cry or feel her anger, whatever the theme was for that day.
Well, you have some very high cycling enthusiasts in here with you. So I think we would all appreciate that.
Absolutely.
And it's really relatable. I mean, obviously, our podcast, that we've all used our pain for greater purpose, even outside of our 9-to-5s, fulfilling that kind of piece of our heart that I feel like almost exists in a lot of grievers. So it's really amazing just to see like how much you've just completely, as Kelsey said, dove into that world. And now it's just your complete world. Like, how has that transition from like going to 9-to-5 to now everything is about grief? Like, do you ever get triggered still, like talking about grief? I'm so curious about that.
Oh my God, there's so much there. I don't feel like I get triggered talking about grief. Sometimes I'll get almost, but I will get triggered by people's response to mine sometimes, especially because I tend to sway toward the light. And like, I love the grief community because we need a space to not be okay. And I think we also need a space to be okay after a loss and to have that permission to want to live it up and love life again, you know, because we didn't die. We are here and it is a gift. So I would say that's been a struggle of mine in finding my space and feeling secure of who I am in that space and what I represent. I mean, I think as far as my work has gone, it's really evolved. Early on, it was really about like surviving the battle lines of widowhood. Like, how do I raise kids alone? How do I cope with these big emotions? All the different secondary losses that you have to navigate. And then kind of moving into, wow, there's this thing called post-traumatic growth and I can transform through this experience. And whoa, like seeing all of the good that can also come. You know, David Kessler, his work around meaning making, that helped me a lot. Realizing that the facts of the death stay the same, but the story can change and that I have the power to control that. And so did a lot of work there. And now most recently, it's kind of evolved more into spirituality and dharma, your dharma being your soul's purpose, and believing that these tragedies guide us to our truth. And so I've been helping widows mainly with, yeah, discovering their dharma, their soul's purpose, and understanding who they are now in the aftermath of their loss.
You hit on so many things I want to ask like 10 million questions about. You are just such a wealth of knowledge. I need to narrow down what I want to focus on. Okay, so you dropped post-traumatic growth. Can you first just educate our listeners what that means, how you embody it, and how you coach your clients to embody it?
Yeah, totally. So post-traumatic growth is a term that was coined by Richard Tedeschi, I think in like the 1960s. And they were studying survivors of trauma and they realized that, you know, many of them also had like positive changes after going through a degree of trauma. And trauma is subjective. So, you know, this could be big T trauma, it could be small T trauma, but anything that is like big enough to basically rock your foundation, your core, so that you kind of like see the world entirely differently. And so they've narrowed down 5 different areas of post-traumatic growth. I'll try to get them right here. But one is like resilience and strength, you know, just noticing how much stronger and capable you are, relationship changes. And I see this as both like a positive and a negative because we lose a lot of people in grief, but we also gain a lot. Spiritual changes is a big one. You know, you might be like, God, why did you do this to me? You know, and kind of have to mend your relationship with God, faith, higher power source, whatever you want to call it. There's a deeper appreciation for life, I think, is number 4 or one of the, this is in no order. And then new possibilities. So I love, there's a quote by Helen Keller, and I probably put it in the book, but it's like, you know, you can stay fixated on the door that has closed, or you can look at all the others that are opening for you. Right. And I think that's, you know, once you start to notice these other areas of like, wow, I've really grown, I've really changed and evolved, like, how much more can I do? So the way I teach this to my clients is I just educate them on what it is. And then I try to ask them to reflect on how they themselves have changed and how that can plant the seeds for meaning making. How, yes, it is tragic and it's awful that your loved one is not here. And we have to honor that. And can we start to see some of the growth and goodness that has come to start to change the narrative and see that they get to create whatever narrative they want.
That's amazing. And in the way that you talk about that, and I'm one of the people, I was like, I want to hear a little bit more about post-traumatic growth because I don't know a lot about it. And I think that's really like the different states that you kind of were talking about. And speaking of post-traumatic growth, when and where and how did you kind of get the idea to write the book? And were people in your life supportive? Who was the first person you went to whenever you decided you wanted to do it? How did that process go?
So for post-traumatic growth, a great resource is Option B by Sheryl Sandberg. She talks a lot about it. But in terms of my book, I think I started, you know, people always were like, you're a great writer, you should write a book, da 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 da. And so that started planting the seeds for sure. My aunt, Barbara Bingham, she's Ian's aunt actually, but I call her my aunt because she's been an incredible support. She was really like, Emily, you need to write a book. Like, stop fucking around. You need to write this. And I was like, okay. So I remember running on the beach one day. I was in Florida with my parents. And I came up with this concept I wanted to write about, like, hang loose. Like, how do we loosen our grip on life and ride the waves of grief? Because Ian was a surfer. And that was my big idea. So I like hired a coach or was about to hire a coach. I did like the 30-day book writing challenge by some guy on social media. I had like the whole outline and everything. And I was just like, I don't know. I just don't, this doesn't feel right. Or I just got like busy with other stuff and I kind of just let it fall by the wayside. And then about a year late, I think I had actually announced it too to my social media following. And I was like, I'm going to write this book. It's going to be great. And then it just like nothing happened.
Really holding yourself accountable.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Ian would always say, you know, it's always about the intention, right, Em? So yeah, I kind of just like let it fall by the wayside. But I did think, I think I trusted that it would happen one of these days. And it did, because a year later, an editor slipped into my DMs and was like, hey, I saw that you mentioned that you were writing a book. Are you still writing it? Because I think you have a book in you. And I was like, oh, okay. So we talked and, you know, we exchanged. She had her idea and I kind of had mine. And we kind of, that's kind of how Love and Grief was born. I really felt it was important to tie in parts of my story. She wanted more of like a how-to guide that people could really, they, you know, you can open it up and it's like, all right, like toolkit for anger or whatever. Like, and so we just kind of came up with the concept together. And yeah, that's how this book came to life.
That's amazing. And it's so great to see kind of the combination, as you were kind of mentioning, like through your experiences and stories, as well as these really actionable like tips and tools that people can use. And there's almost like a science behind it in a sense that you're integrating with personal anecdote. And I think that that makes it really useful for people who are going through grief. And one of those kind of frameworks you talked about, the six C's: curiosity, community, coping, connections, compassion, and consciousness. And we kind of wanted to first like just do a little brief overview on those if you wanted to highlight any.
Yeah, I wanted to like, I was like, what are like, you know, this is like 5 years of lessons I've learned from grief. So I was like, what are like the big like takeaways, like the pillars, right? And so that's kind of what the six C's of grief I kind of tried to distill down into. So yeah, curiosity there for me, and it's actually, do you guys watch Ted Lasso?
Yeah, yes. Love Ted Lasso.
I can't remember what season it was, but it was something about like curiosity over criticism. And I love that quote. And I think it applies to us so much in grief, because it's so easy to criticize ourselves. Like if you're feeling a certain way, I shouldn't be feeling this way. What's wrong with me? Right. And it's like, no, get curious about it. Why am I feeling this way? Well, you know, how is this coming up? Like, can I sit with this a little bit more? And so curiosity, number one, and also like curiosity in terms of, you know, just relating to yourself. But also in educating yourself about grief or in any hard thing that you're going through. It's like literally Google it and you're going to find 1,000 resources on what's there. And then we can break through all of the false information that really sets us up for suffering. So curiosity is number one. Community, huge, like we were talking about, like find your people who are also navigating something hard, and that'll kick you right out of any victimhood mindset that you have, because it's like others are doing this too and I'm not alone. It's not just me. Coping skills, so finding the tools to regulate your nervous system to cope with grief, because that can feel really scary, but it's like remembering that there are tools that can support me through this. Connection not just to communities around you but to your loved one. I mean, that was huge for me early on, is like knowing that I didn't have to disconnect and let go from Ian. So finding ways to maintain that connection. Compassion. Again, grievers are so hard on themselves. It's like, I should be further along. I shouldn't be feeling this way. I'm doing it wrong. And or like why I have so many like soloed moms who are like, I used to be able to do so much. I'm like, yes, but do you realize that you are taking on the roles of two people, your own grief, your kid's grief? Like, so compassion is huge in just being able to see yourself and everything that you're going through. And then consciousness. And like, I feel like I was on autopilot before my husband's death, like just straight up living by the rules that society told me to. And then this whole thing happened and it broke me wide open. And I was like, oh my God, I've been qualifying my emotions as good or bad or right or wrong. Like that was the first like light bulb. Like they just are, right? And like, there's no real recipe for success or happiness. It's all just like my perspective on it and the lens that I choose to see life through. And so yeah, consciousness, I think, is a big one. And it's, again, it's like that, the ability to create, like life literally is whatever you decide to make it to be. And that to me is like consciousness.
That is so well said, and I love that framework, and thank you for explaining each of the C's, because I did feel like that was a really good overview and kind of way to break down, and I feel like we've all looked at a lot of grief resources, and I've never seen anything explained quite like that. So for our listeners, just one of the many examples of ways Emily very tactfully explains things in her book in a really digestible way. Also, what stood out, the illustrations. And I think I saw a little something on your social media about it, but I would love for the listeners to hear what went into that process and combining the visual elements.
Yeah. So, and I'm going to not take full credit for this, because the people at Quarto like kind of came up with this idea and I loved it, but they were like, they put flowers on the cover because they're both a sign of vitality and growth, but you also have flowers at funerals. And same with the colors. The blue is representative of like the grief and kind of the darkness and the more melancholy tones. And then the orange is kind of like the vibrancy, the energy, right? The rebirth and thriving that can come when you undergo a life-altering loss.
It's a beautiful book. I got it in the mail today, and I actually I literally took a video flipping through it and showing them. It's stunning. Everything about it is beautiful. So congratulations on that too, of course. I kind of love to see the little stuff, the messaging that you just described putting in there.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm curious if you throughout the book writing process felt like you heard any of your husband's voice kind of as you were writing the book. I know you mentioned obviously getting emotional writing the speech for the book, but I'm curious if through the actual book writing process, if you felt like there was anything there where you could hear Ian's voice throughout that time.
Yeah, I definitely cried writing this book. Yeah. I think not so much the practical tools and, the real coachy stuff, but absolutely when I would share about our journey and have to revisit those moments. And I don't know if I heard Ian's voice per se in writing the book, but I definitely hear it, now in situations where I need to ask him for guidance or a sign. I'll do something and I can feel him laughing at me and being oh my God, that was ridiculous. Or, but yeah, I think maybe because the book was so much about the aftermath of his death, maybe, it just probably brought up more unprocessed grief that I might not have been able to feel at the time that it was happening for me.
You've kind of have this online presence and have been available and made yourself available to talk about grief and all of the things you've gone through. Did you find any difficulty when you were working on this project with another team of people to kind of be well, this is my story still? Because I feel like that could be something that could be kind of hard to become conformed to, I guess, to kind of know that on social and on your blog, you can do whatever you want. But this is kind of a project that's your heart that you're working with other people.
Totally. And it's been a learning experience for me, right? This is my first book. It's my first foot in publishing. And honestly, I was just so grateful to have the opportunity. I was tell me what you want me to do.
Yeah.
obviously keeping my integrity, right? I did really but having my story in there was super important to me. But in terms of the vision that they had, I was that's great. It's perfect. It reminded me of option B, actually, where she talks about her story and then they have practical tools, and she actually writes it with a I'm doing promo for her book too, with a psychologist. And I loved that format. So the fact that they wanted to do something similar for mine, I was sure, that's great. Nora McInerney's Hot Young Widows book, they had a lot of breakout boxes, because in grief too, I couldn't read super long, wordy, descriptive, flowery stuff. It was to the point.
No, I think that mix, it makes it really digestible. And yes, right after you go through a loss, you cannot process a textbook type style. We want things to feel conversational, digestible, everything. Do you have a favorite section or a favorite lesson or anything that maybe came out of you so quickly first right away? Any call outs that really you connect with?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, for me, I tend to really sway to the light. So like, I love like the grow through grief section on post-traumatic growth and meaning making, just because, and embodying a mindset to move forward. Those were like such big concepts for me that really changed the trajectory of my grief journey. So I definitely love that. I think duality is a big one, and I talk about it probably at multiple times in the book. But what I mean by that is the ability to hold the tragedy of the experience and the goodness that has come from the experience as well, and not to feel guilty about it, but to just have room for both. Two things can be true. Two opposing things can be true, right? In grief. And so switching from that either or mentality to the both and was huge. And then I think thrive, honestly, like I want to like revisit that more, because I think all this work around spirituality and consciousness, like there's so much there, and I feel like I'm just getting started.
So beautiful. No, thank you for sharing and going into that. And I hope everyone listening goes out and gets it. I would say, do you have something where you're like, if you walk away with at least just this, I'm so happy I did my job. Like, what is the big takeaway you would love people? And you talked about a lot of favorites, so maybe it's one of those, but I at least want to pose that way.
Yeah, no, I think the biggest one is that you can survive your worst nightmare. You can go through your worst nightmare and still come out living and loving life. Like, you can create your dream life from your worst nightmare. You know, it just takes surrounding yourself with the right communities, educating yourself, and recognizing that like we are so much more powerful than we give ourselves credit. So I think that would be the biggest takeaway is it's not over. It's not.
So I wanted to touch a little bit on kind of more of like your personal life and kind of what you're up to now. So you mentioned you have a partner. I'm curious if you have any tips or for instance, you said you also were a cycle teacher. One of my cycle teachers has gone through the grief of her husband. And I actually started reading this book and was like, when I'm done reading it and taking my notes, I'm going to lend it to her because I think it's just a great resource. But do you have any tips or ideas or thoughts on when, how you got back into the dating scene as being a widow and a little bit about your partner and kind of as life is for you now?
Oh my God. That's going to be like a whole book in itself. Yeah, I know. I left that out because I did a course on dating and I didn't do it by myself because I didn't feel equipped to. I brought in a therapist and relationship coach, mainly for me. I was like, help me, and then we're going to turn this into a course for others. But yeah, that was really confusing. And there are no resources out there for widows, because I'd say the biggest difference between a breakup or a divorce versus a loss is like we're taught not to let go. We're taught to hold on, to maintain the connection. Whereas they're kind of like, all right, you move on, get over, onto the next one. And I know it's not that simple. I don't mean to minimize that process. But for me, I would like go on relationship podcasts and try to educate myself on how do I date and or how do I heal. And I was like, how the hell am I supposed to like date some guy, but I'm like still in love with my husband. Like, is this some kinky shit we're talking about? So yeah, like again, that duality of like trusting that I could still maintain that connection to my husband and open my heart to somebody new was really hard. But yeah, I started dating really early on. I just missed being intimate with someone and I jumped on the apps. I think, again, I was just trying to like fix it. You know, I just wanted to make it right. Like just plug a new guy in the place and it's all going to be fine. And that was like not the case. And, you know, I got myself into a relationship early on. It didn't work out. It like amplified my grief right around Christmas. It was awful, but it was like the best thing ever because it forced me to really heal and get to know myself. And I think from there, I really focused on me. And I don't know, found more clarity around what it was I was actually looking for in a partner.
And also the fact that your husband was your college sweetheart, like you hadn't really dated all that much to begin with. So that's already confusing in modern times. And then throw this in. No, I think that's so relatable. Like there are no resources. And that's such a good point that it's like, yeah, you break up with someone, you're supposed to get over them so quickly. And now you're holding both at once. So how has it been with your current partner? And how do you guys talk about Ian? Since of course, he's still the father of your children. It sounds like you have a beautiful blended family and you're doing so wonderfully, but tell us about how that relationship has been.
Yeah, it's been great. We've been together now for 2 years. We're in a really good place right now, but it hasn't always been that way. It's been like a slow burn of learning to trust that love feels different to me now. It's different to me now as a, I guess we started dating when I was 35-year-old widow versus an 18-year-old freshman in college, right? It's the grief and communicating that like I can still maintain a spiritual relationship with my husband that doesn't minimize the relationship that we have has been a challenge, and especially because I talk about it all over social media. So, you know, it takes someone who is really secure, and he's pointed it out. You know, there were times early on where he's like, you know, you're wearing earrings that say I and B, Ian Bingham. He's like, that's hard for me to see. It makes me feel like I'm not as significant. And I think you have to be really honest about where you are in your grief. I think early on I would have been like, well, fuck you, I'm out. But like, you know, later on, because I needed that. I needed those physical reminders. Later I was able to say, okay, well, I don't need those physical reminders to keep being close. And what matters to me is that, you know, if I'm going to be in relationship, I do have to care about what makes my partner feel secure too. So I think for anyone out there who's starting to date, like if you're entering into a relationship, it is about the two of you, right? Like you need to honor what you need, but you also need to be open and compassionate towards what your partner needs. So it's been an education for both of us, educating him and me holding space for all the misinterpretations that he could be having. But we've gotten to like a really, really awesome place. So it's exciting. Yeah.
I just really appreciate all the kind of like advice you're giving on this topic, because I know that it's one that I'm sure a lot of people have trouble navigating. And kind of also going off of your communication with him, how has, and if you're open to talking about this, your communication been with your kids of introducing somebody new that isn't their dad?
Yeah, that's been hard too, you know, because Thea was so young when Ian died. He was 1 year old. He has like no recollection. And so he grew up in a household of just Izzy and me. We're like painting his nails, moving dress up. So like once David and his two boys come around, he's like, yes, like I've got some like guys to hang out with. So for him, it's been like easy, like no, like super smooth transition. Izzy, it has been a little bit more, it's been slow for her to like warm up. And so I've talked to her about it. And, you know, I said, well, what's coming up for you? And she's like, well, I miss daddy. I want daddy. He's replacing daddy. And so helping her own narrative, and helping her hold that duality, you know, David isn't replacing Ian. You will always have your biological father, and you can connect to him in all of these different ways. And, you know, David would love to be like your dad. He'd like to kind of be that role for you. But no one will ever replace your dad. So just kind of, again, teaching her that she gets to have a whole different relationship with David outside of hers with Ian.
Thank you for sharing and talking about that. I know that it is. And I asked because it's something that people don't talk about. And I think that it's super important too. Are there ways when you're continually like trying to keep Ian's spirit alive or your relationship with Ian alive when with the kids and with Izzy, do you have like practices or things that you guys do to kind of talk about him or bring him up or keep the spirit of him alive, whether it's a tradition or just, I'm not sure, a ritual?
Yeah, definitely. So early on, I was like, we're going to go camping every Father's Day. We're going to do like all the things, right? And we did for a while. We haven't as much, but I'd say one thing that's kind of tried and true is we always celebrate his birthday. And so we'll like bake a cake or eat his favorite food, but we'll always remember him that way. And I try to, you know, show them pictures of him. There's pictures, you know, around our house. And that's been different too, because now that I'm living with David, some have gone into more discreet areas or just into their room. We light wish paper every now and then too, which is awesome because they get to write messages to Daddy and then send it up into the sky. And sometimes they'll just want to do it like randomly as well. Or if it's like a full moon or something. And it's, you know, Ian's 5-year death anniversary is coming up this month. And that's a big one. So that would be one where we'd probably light some wish paper, talk about him, look at pictures. Yeah.
Those all sound so special and so thoughtful. And I love the celebrating of the birthday versus like the death anniversary day. Like the birthday feels happier and more celebratory. And I think we've talked about in some episodes too, finding those right rituals, but it sounds so beautiful. And you're just such an inspiration to so many people. And we're so excited and happy you wrote this book and you're sharing it with us and our listeners. We do have one kind of fun question we like to end on with people that's unrelated to grief. So we'll throw that in really fast and then want you to plug everything. First, are you a Taylor Swift fan?
I used to like not be at all, but she's totally grown on me.
Okay, love to hear that. We are three big Taylor Swift fans. So we like to at least ask if you have a favorite song, era, album, anything that you've been like listening to lately.
Of Taylor.
Yeah.
I like, is it Blank Space?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's my favorite.
Good
one.
Answer.
Or Shake It Off, because there's a lot of haters out there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's perfect to shake off the haters on social media. Yes,
exactly.
Yeah. That was your final induction into the crew, was answering the Taylor Swift question. So you're in with us now.
Oh, I made it. Okay, good.
You are in and you are awesome. Please share with everyone listening, where do we need to follow you? Where do we get your content? Where do we buy your book? Plug it all, please.
Oh my gosh. All right. So Love and Grief, you can get at like most book retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can also find it on my website, which is movethroughgrief.com. That's THRU. I'm on Instagram, Emily P. Bingham. I'm on TikTok. I think I actually just moved my handle there. So I might change my handle, so I might have to check it. But I think it's still Emily Moves Through Grief. I'm also on Facebook, not as active there. But yeah, those are the primary spots that you can find me.
Amazing. Well, everyone be sure to follow and share and buy the book and send it to a friend. And as always, you can follow us at The Morning Crew and send us any feedback on this episode. But Emily, thank you so much for your time. You're amazing. And have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, ladies. It was so great being on.
Bye.